Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
You're listening to Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast for the 25th of January 2023. I'm David Taylor from the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined as usual by Phil Bishop, editor of our online news service. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things in Devon?
A bit misty today, actually. Yeah, a bit misty, a bit wintry. Yeah. I imagine it's much the same with you.
Much the same. Can't complain, though.
No, indeed. Everything's going to get better soon, I'm sure. So what are we going to talk about today, Phil? We've got some, a couple of interesting topics. We've also got a guest joining us. I'm not going to reveal who our guest is yet. That will happen in due course. But we don't often have guests on the podcast. But this guest, I think, is very well worth welcoming. So we'll look forward to that. But we've got a couple of topics to get out of the way first. A couple of interesting stories which you've posted this week, Phil.
Yeah, I thought we'd start off. I mean, lots of people have been talking about this in the papers and current affairs podcasts and so on, which is the levelling up funding round two, which was announced last week. 111 projects around the country have been given some central government funding towards them. Notably, the Eden Project North in Morecambe has got a big slug of money. £50 million, and Cardiff City Council's Crossrail Phase 1 gets £50 million. And you look at this, and the government wants us to go, isn't this great? Look at all these projects around the regions getting money to get going, and it all comes under this umbrella banner of levelling up. Yes, which I said before was a stupid term. But inevitably, and I'm not the first to observe this, you can't pick winners without picking losers. And so you've got people like the mayor of the Birmingham region, who's a conservative politician, saying this is all terrible. How come nice wealthy places have got money for their projects and Birmingham hasn't? We need some levelling up too, please.
Well, they're getting HS2. Why are they complaining? They're going to have a lovely new high speed rail link. Yeah, to London, of course.
You're right, and I'm with you on that. I think Birmingham's not got too much to complain about when it comes to government money at the moment. But it's just the whole process, it seems to me, might need rethinking. One of the things that I find slightly concerning is the sheer amount of money that local authorities spend on consultants in putting their bids together. It's been reported that it's more than £70 million has been spent on consultants over the past two rounds of funding that we've had, which is nice work. Arcadis alone say that they've supported 40 levelling up applications, levelling up fund applications, and they claim a success rate of 90%. So they're making their sales pitch there. Come to us and you've got a 9 out of 10 chance of getting your money. I think I asked Arcadis how much money they've made out of this process, but I don't think they told me.
No, that's a bit too sensitive a thing.
But it does strike me that this particular process of local authorities competing for central government money, it has its roots, like so much of modern government or present day government, in Michael Heseltine, who started off the City Challenge scheme, which is mainly, as the name suggests, it's cities pitching for a share of it. And that was also part and parcel of his promoting the idea of city mayors, as in elected mayors who are proper political figureheads, rather than just the chairman of the council who take...
Yeah, somebody in a big hat.
In a chain who does a year's turn and gets shaped for the round opening libraries and things, and then passes on to someone else. So it's not just a ceremonial role. The city and city region mayors that we now have, another Heseltine thing, and it's all about trying to instill civic pride. A lot of the urban regeneration policies stem from his time as Environment Secretary. And Boris Johnson famously called himself a Brexity Hezer. I mean, obviously, Heseltine was not in any sense a Brexiteer.
Certainly pro-European.
But that aside, the kind of interventionist, paternalistic, business-led liberal conservative politics that I think characterises the current government and the government's probably since Margaret Thatcher, to be honest, it seems to be more to do with Michael Heseltine than Margaret Thatcher, which I think is quite interesting. It's not often said. I don't think he's necessarily given the credit to current political thinking that he deserves, I think.
It's interesting. I hadn't really sort of factored Hezer into the equation, really. But I suppose you're absolutely right. You don't hear from him much these days. He must be getting on a bit. But yes, these sort of regional regeneration things are very much his sort of thing. I think the phrase levelling up, we've discussed this in the past, it's a bit meaningless, really. If you look at some of the, you very helpfully posted details of every single one of the 111 applications that have been successful. A lot of them are in areas which you would think have been neglected over the years, up in the northeast and northwest of England, Northern Ireland, and Wales, and indeed down here in the southwest, where I think, particularly in Cornwall, things tend to get overlooked. And there are pockets of, I suppose you would call it deprivation in these areas. But there are one or two projects here which sort of stood out to me, which I wondered how they qualified, because they're in fairly affluent areas. The one that the Malvern Theatre. Malvern Theatre is an organisation is getting £20 million to build a new outdoor theatre and associated facilities. Bournemouth and Poole Seafront's going to get £18 million to spruce it up. And I wouldn't have thought Bournemouth was a deprived area, especially if you look at Sandbanks, one of the most expensive places you can possibly live in the UK. But the one which really struck me was in Canterbury, Unlocking the Tales of England, which sounds like a sort of a Disneyfied tourist attraction, but it's a not the redevelopment, but the sort of rejuvenation of Canterbury Castle. And for somebody who grew up in East Kent and visited Canterbury very regularly, I didn't even know Canterbury had a castle. So that one's a very curious one, but £20 million to unlock the tales of England. I'm not sure that that's the sort of thing that people think about when we talk about levelling up. We tend to think of providing much needed transport links, for example, and community enterprises in former industrial regions of the north, not heritage trails down in affluent Canterbury.
Yes, I think that there have been calls that the government should, the Department for Levelling Up, ought to show they're working on this. It ought to say, okay, these are the projects that didn't get the funds, and here's why. Mm. I wonder how much it depends on the expertise of filling in the forms, whether there's certain buzzwords that you have to use.
Well, I imagine that's where Arcadis earns its money, I assume. Yeah. You know, they'll tell you how to finesse your application so you get through. I mean, I'm not criticising Malvern Theatres or Canterbury's Unlocking the Tales of England or Bournemouth Seafront. I mean, I'm sure they're all deserving of investment, public sector investment. You know, why not? But it's just that's not the sort of thing that I think we've been led to believe levelling up is about. I think we tend to think that levelling up is more to do with, well, we're told that it's to do with sort of balancing the region so that areas which have been neglected and don't have the advantage of the sort of affluent southeast get a bit of a leg up. And that doesn't really sort of fit into this this list as far as I can tell.
And the other point to mention on this topic, I think, is the fact that all these projects don't get their money if they don't get going and start digging quickly enough.
Very quickly.
Yeah, they've really got to get a move on. The deadline for spending the money, March 2025.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they need to get going.
When you, I think I know what they mean by the deadline for spending the money, but does it literally mean that the money is in the supply chain's bank accounts by that deadline, or that work has started. I mean, I don't, it's a bit of a grey area, I think, because of course you've got 2 years to get your project going. And I'm sure these projects obviously have been in the planning for a long time. So most of them, one hopes, it's just simply a question of hitting the start button and getting things going. But a lot of them will need to procure a contractor and consultants and a whole supply chain, I imagine.
I think in many cases they've already got them on board, certainly for the preparation work, for the enabling works.
Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah, two years isn't a long time for some of these. I mean, having a look, the regeneration of town centres, you know. Barnsley, the first one on the list, Barnsley Metropolitan Borough Council, Barnsley Futures, and it's Barnsley Central. So that's only 10 million. New outdoor activity park in Barnsley. I don't know. I'm just reading now, but there are some projects here which clearly do involve a lot of work, and they're not going to happen overnight. I mean, obviously the big winners, the ones like the Eden Project North and Cardiff City's Crossrail project, they're both 50 million pound projects. Let's hope that they have got all their ducks in a row and they're ready to start tomorrow.
I think the point is they're more than 50 million pound projects, but they're getting 50 million pound of government work to get them going and make them feasible. So we're not saying these things have to be built within 2 years. We're just saying you've got to have done, you know, Eden Project,
you've got to spend the money.
We'll have to have done 50 million pounds worth of work in the next 2 years.
Yes, so that could just be enabling works and consultants and designers, couldn't it?
I'm looking forward to Morecambe's project, actually. I used to go to Morecambe as a child. It was Bradford-on-Sea, it used to be, or it used to be known as, maybe still is. And it was always with my grandmother's favourite place. And I happened to pass through there, I don't know, 10 years ago now, I suppose, and was surprised by how sad and sorry it was. So, yeah, Morecambe does need a leg up.
Yeah, I mean that's a fate suffered by nearly all of our seaside towns. You know, with the possible exception of Bournemouth. Again, I'm not picking on Bournemouth, but I think it's one of the more affluent ones. But yeah, I mean, Margate, Ramsgate, where I grew up, and Ilfracombe, near where I live now, they're fairly typical of the sort of down at heel former resorts. Everybody goes to Miami these days, or Florida anyway. Skills cards, those have been in the news recently. Some changes are being introduced, which we shouldn't be surprised about because they've been in the planning for a decade or more, haven't they?
Yes.
Tell us about those.
All that's happened is that the Construction Skills Certification Scheme and Construction Leadership Council have basically put out an announcement saying this is how we're going to support the transition from old regime of skills cards in the industry to the new regime, which we always knew about. It was coming, but we'd kind of forgotten about it, hoped it wasn't going to happen, a lot of people did, in quite the way that it is. The point is, to have a construction skills certification scheme, a CSCS card, or any card with that logo on it, which includes PAL card, which is not a powered access license, even though PAL stands for powered access license, but powered access operators certification, and all these other different cards which are in the industry. You are supposed to have an NVQ or similar qualification that has demonstrated your competence. You've got to actually demonstrate, you know, you've got to earn the card. Now, when the CSCS cards first came along, a lot of them were handed out to people who've been in the industry. If you've been a joiner for 30 years, working on sites, 20 years, it was taken as read that you're competent, otherwise you'd have been fired by now, and you got your card, broadly speaking. Still had to do the health and safety tick box test thing. Anyway, a lot of people got their cards by what are known as grandfather rights, and these are now, this grandfather rights are ending in 2025, and you won't get your automatic card renewal. The old cards go, new cards come in, and everyone will have to have, not necessarily an NVQ, if you've got a professional qualification and you can demonstrate. And there's some very complicated flowchart. I say complicated. They're not that complicated, but there's a whole series of flowcharts that CSCS have produced to show what you need to do, depending on what card you've got and you're looking to renew. And I've got one of these flowcharts in front of me. If you're replacing a a blue skilled worker card issued under industry accreditation. If you've got an NVQ or a City and Guilds craft certificate, you can jump to step four. You can just apply for the card.
Right.
And you're probably going to get it. And your employer may be able to claim some of the money back from CITB to help towards the cost of that. If you don't have an NVQ or SNVQ and you don't have a City and Guilds certificate or apprenticeship or an relevant overseas qualification, you have got to register for an assessment, NVQ assessment process. Now, you're not going to have to go to school, but you do have to find someone, pay them money, and they're going to come sit with you and say whether you can do your job or not. And this raises the prospect of some commentators I've seen writing, the prospect of some 50-year-old person who's pretty expert in their job being judged by potentially a young whippersnapper know-nothing who's got no particular expertise in their job but works for a training centre as an assessor. And the question is, how many, and they're said to be 60,000 more, maybe 70,000, 75,000 people with these grandfather rights cards, how many of those are going to say, you know what, sod it, I was thinking about retiring early, or I was thinking about, you know, taking up gardening or going to work as an odd job person. I can't be bothered to go through with all of this. This is another thing that's going to tip me out of the industry. And I think that's a genuine fear. And I don't entirely understand what the rush is, because these people with these cards, I think, are back, you know, towards the back end of their career.
Yeah.
Why don't we just let them naturally, what's it called, natural wastage? I mean, they will leave the industry in their own good time anyway. And as long as new entrants, we have the NVQ thing. Because I support the idea of it's lovely to have a nice, qualified, certified, competent workforce. Mm. But I'm not sure it's worth the effort to rush it through.
Well, that's it. It happens all of a sudden, doesn't it?
If you can call 10 years rushing.
Well, yes. We knew they wanted to do this 10 years ago, but that it wasn't as if they had set out a roadmap so that we could follow it and people could be ready by March 2025 and have all their all their qualifications sorted out in time. As you said earlier, we'd actually forgotten about this and they're just reminding us, and oops, we've only got a couple of years. And so I don't know. I think a lot of people will leave the industry. In fact, there has been quite a lot said generally about the sort of UK workforce, not just construction, about people retiring early. This is a sort of one of the fallouts from the COVID pandemic, that a lot of people, during the pandemic found that they could cope quite well without having to go to work, and consequently didn't. These are people in their sort of 50s and 60s. So a lot of people have left. There's been quite a lot of, quite a few efforts to entice some of them back into the workforce. And some people have gone back, but a lot of people have left prematurely, perhaps, or certainly sooner than they would have done otherwise. So this could be another, as you say, another tipping point that makes people think that they could quite easily do without all the hassle and simply either retire or get a part-time job or do something completely different. And I think if they did take that route that you mentioned, which is of natural wastage, people who are in their 50s are going to leave the industry within a few years anyway. And then they could just phase it in, and it wouldn't create an upheaval. It wouldn't create a sudden loss of skills in the industry. And this is an industry which, of course, has a lot of difficulty attracting sufficient skills into the workforce. So, it makes me wonder why they think they have to do it all of a sudden, have this sort of set cut-off point.
If anyone in the industry knows, the whole issue of skills cards has always been controversial. I mean, the thinking behind it is utterly well-meaning, as I said, and the goal and the aim is a good one. It's how do we get there, omelets and eggs and all of that. And there have been many, many people upset about being they take it as a personal slight. You know, I've been doing this job for, and suddenly someone's saying that I'm not qualified or I'm not competent. And what we need to remember, of course, is that it's not a legal requirement. It's not like driving a car where you have to have a driving license. There's no legal requirement to have one of these cards. A legal requirement to be competent and to be, you know, be trained and this, that, and the other.
Sure.
But the actual card scheme is not. And you can't come up with an alternative card scheme to the CSCS because basically the Construction Leadership Council says, no, this is the card scheme. This is what we're going behind.
Mm.
There's no democracy involved. No one's voted for the Construction Leadership Council. No one's voted for CSCS. It's all, okay, I mean, trade associations are behind CSCS and
yes, of
trade
course.
Unions are involved. And they are only as democratic as their members get off their backsides and make them to be. I mean, like all these organisations, like parish councils, most people just sit back and let everyone else do the work and only complain when something happens they don't like, kind of thing, but don't actually get involved. So maybe the lesson is get involved in your organisation, folks, if you don't like what's going on.
But I mean, if the vast majority of Tier 1 contractors actually require people on their sites to have a CSCS card, which is the case, it doesn't matter whether it's a legal requirement or not. If you want to get the work, you've got to, you know, you've got to satisfy the requirements of the employer. And so it really is a de facto license to operate for many people, isn't it?
Yeah. And we haven't even touched on the whole question of bogus cards or how easy it is to get cards. There might be genuine cards, but there are plenty of bad actors out there who will basically give you them if you pay the money.
Right. So have we done that topic, Phil? Are we going to move on?
Well, I would like, I've asked both the Construction Leadership Council and the Construction Skills Certification Scheme organisation if one or other of them couldn't put someone up to talk to us, because I think the questions that we and listeners have should be answered directly by someone. So I would hope that in a future episode of Reconstruction, we will have a guest on who will explain that it's actually not that hard, it's straightforward, it's a good thing, and it's and these people are whinging about nothing.
Mm.
I'm sure that's what they'll tell us.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Well, Phil, I think it's time to introduce our guest. As I said, we don't often have guests on the podcast these days, but we definitely thought it would be a good idea to welcome our guest this week. He's John Allcote. He's head of construction output and development at the National Accounts and Economic Statistics at the Office for National Statistics, obviously the government's statistical organisation. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be quite familiar with his output, produces the monthly, it is monthly, isn't it, John, the statistics that you produce?
Yep.
And we pore over these at the Construction Index and find out what's happening and, you know, who's up, who's down and all the rest of it. So welcome, John, to the podcast. It's great to have you on. I thought maybe we should start simply by asking you what the latest ONS figures tell us about what's happening in UK construction at the moment.
Yeah, thank you for letting me come on the podcast today.
Not at all.
So yeah, so I'd like to answer this question in sort of two parts. First part is sort of the more longer term sort of view, sort of from sort of the pre-pandemic sort of comparison.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, latest figures sort of shows us to be about 4% above where we were sort of pre-pandemic. And I think it's probably fair to say, compared to sort of many other sectors across the economy, construction's done sort of reasonably well. We did see some very large drops of around about 40% sort of in those early lockdowns. But it's fair to say, I think, you know, particularly with sectors like infrastructure and the repair and maintenance side, where we saw obviously the race for space as people, you know, wanted to build home offices and similar, perhaps had a bit more disposable income with the not having the commute to work and things like that. You know, I think it's pretty fair that construction did pretty well in those sort of first year, 18 months at the start of the lockdown compared to other sectors.
Yeah.
I think as well, though, probably sort of word of caution that over sort of the last 6 months, you know, we have probably seen the sector slow down a little bit in growth terms. I mean, it's all relative. You know, I think we're still probably on for around about 5-6% annual output growth this year, which in normal times would be very, very good. But it is sort of noticeable, I think, in recent months, particularly the housing side has sort of plateaued a little bit, both on a new work and a repair and maintenance perspective. So we keep getting lots of mentions about the cost of living crisis, you know, from our contributors to our monthly survey. So I think it is, you know, starting to take hold.
John, can I just interrupt?
Yeah, sure.
So to cut you off, you say this year is an ONS year. That's a calendar year, 2023. You're not a sort of March to April, April to March year, are you? You talk 2023, don't you?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, we do a calendar year. So, yeah. So, yeah, it's our annual growth rates for 2022. Obviously, we still haven't got December's data. December data comes out 10th of Feb. But obviously, we've got 11 months out of the 12. So we can give a pretty good guess as to what that annual figure might be.
So 5%, you're saying for 2022 or this year, 2023?
For 2022, sorry, yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, you produce these figures every month, John. How do you get your information? Because, I mean, that's a huge, very broad range of activity to look at. How do you get your information? How do you process it?
Yeah, good question again. I mean, we are reliant on businesses in the sector to supply their data. So, you know, it is a big effort. We have a sample of about 8,000 businesses from across the construction industry that we go out to each month. It is quite a detailed survey for a short-term ONS survey. We ask 11 questions in total. So we ask for the businesses to break down their work by the different sectors that you see, you know, housing, infrastructure, repair and maintenance, new work, private industrial, private commercial, etc. So it is quite a detailed undertaking and can be quite burdensome for businesses. So we are very grateful for a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, who get one of our forms to fill it in. In terms of how the sample is constructed, if you are a big business and you're over 100 plus employment, you are in our survey every month. We have a census of activity there. So we've got pretty good coverage of the big boys. And then we take a sample depending on then the size of your business. Sort of, I think if you're 0 to 9, you're in our sample for, I think it's 15 months. If you're 10 to 99, I think it's 27 months or something like that. So we do sort of have a nice cross range of sort of industries and business sizes, which are really important to make sure that we can collate the best estimates possible.
But an awful lot of work in the industry is carried out by a man in a van.
Yeah.
Or the, you know, repair and maintenance stuff. And they might not even be VAT registered. How do you monitor that side of the industry?
Our sampling frame is from something called the Interdepartmental Business Register. So ONS uses that, but other government departments also, you know, use that as a sampling frame. That is any business that's VAT registered and PAYE registered. So we've got a pretty good coverage of those businesses that sort of, you know, go through the normal channels to all the channels that, you know, government sort of use, don't they, to sort of register businesses. We don't make any adjustment for sort of unrecorded activity in our sort of short-term estimates. But as part of the national accounts longer-term process, because there are many estimates of construction activity that ONS produces. So, for example, you know, when it goes through the supply use national accounts balancing process, an under-coverage adjustment will be applied for things like businesses that aren't VAT registered and similar, you know, cash in hand activity, that sort of thing.
How do you say you make the adjustment? How?
We work with colleagues from HMRC, for example, who sort of have, I think, estimates on that sort of activity. It is a very hard thing to predict, obviously, but I think there is a process that sort of is around that, because, yeah, you're right. It is particularly in the construction sector, isn't it? It is a part of activity that you know, is probably a bit more prevalent than other areas, I'd say.
So when you say 2022 construction output grew 5%, how confident are you of that 5% figure, given the adjustments that you have to make?
Well, what I would say is, it's first things first. Our construction output figures are badged as a national statistic. We've gone through the process with the Office for Statistics Regulation, who sort of deemed our statistics to be of the sufficient quality to be badged as a national stat. So I think that's the first thing I would say, is it's almost like the quality stamp seal of approval that we get from sort of the OSR.
Which wasn't always the case, was it? I mean, that's only happened about, what, 5 years ago or something. I may be misremembering, but it's not that long ago.
That's absolutely correct, yep. So we did lose the national statistics badge for a period of time and underwent a development programme to get that back. You know, we developed our output price indices, which again, you know, we tell sort of users are the best measure of price inflation in the industry. Obviously a lot of interest in that at the moment. We've also done a bit of work sort of looking at our revisions and making sure that they were not of a biased nature, which again, we had a bit of criticism for there. But and I think when we look at the analysis over the pandemic, early analysis and trends sort of suggest that a lot of that work has been very beneficial and making sure that we've not gone back to where we were a few years ago. Apologies, I can't remember your initial question about was it about best estimates, wasn't it? Is that right?
Yes, I mean, yeah. Yes, there are assumptions built into, you mentioned, particularly with the, and not even necessarily the black economy, but people who aren't VAT registered. They're trading perfectly legally in construction trades. The government authorities make these sort of assumptions and guesses as to what they contribute to the industry. And you've come up with an all-round figure of 5%, which may be great when we're talking about public sector infrastructure projects, but not so much in the R&M sector. Mm. So how confident are you of that 5% figure?
I would say that it's the old cliche between sort of timeliness and accuracy. So, you know, we produce our on the short term, so we have very timely sort of indicators. So to give you an idea, our December data that we're currently processing, our surveys go out into the field about the 3rd or 4th of January. We closed down the survey at the end of January in a few days' time, and we produced the estimates about sort of 10 days later. So what we do find, obviously, though, is that our response rates at that point tend to be around 75-80% in terms of turnover coverage. So as sort of the time sort of progresses, we will get late and revised sort of survey data from businesses who can't quite meet those sort of early deadlines that we have. So we try to work with businesses, you know, we try our best to sort of get estimates off them as best we can, but it's obviously, as you can imagine, quite a large sort of data collection process to sort of do that. But yeah, and like I say, and then over time, other data sources come in as well that we use. So for example, around about 3-4 years ago, we're now using VAT data as well, but that's not quite as timely as our survey data estimate. So we have to wait around about 4 or 5 months before that comes in. And then, you know, we try to use the benefits of that, which tends to be, you know, the coverage that VAT has rather than us taking a sample on our survey side. So I think it is an estimate, but it's our best estimate with the data sources that we've got available at that point in time.
I mean, when we talk about the construction industry, as I said earlier, it covers an enormous range of activity, everything from sort of muck shifting through to wiring up the lights. And I mean, do you have a set definition of what falls within the bracket of construction? I mean, we've mentioned in the past that a lot of contractors moved into facilities management, emptying bins and serving school dinners and stuff like that, which clearly isn't construction work. Do you have very set categories that these activities have to fall within?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we can't go, deciding what is the construction sector and what it's not. I mean, we have international standards and classifications. You might be aware of the UK standard industrial classification, the UK SIC is sometimes referred to.
We're SIC currently on codes, yeah.
SIC yeah. code, absolutely. I don't want to get too technical, but I'm sure a lot of your listeners are well aware of SIC codes, yes. And things like that.
Yeah.
So construction is as per the SIC section F. It's broadly split into three divisions. Division 41 is where you see house builders and property developers. 42 is where you see the civil engineering firms that undertake the various activity on infrastructure at work. And then 43 is where you sort of tend to see the skilled tradespeople, plumbers, electricians and similar. There's a lot of element that I think the industry probably considers is construction. So the manufacturer of construction products is not picked up by our figures, for example. Okay. That's in the index of production there. A lot of the service type activities, as you mentioned, the facilities management activities there, and things like surveyors and architects, that's picked up by index of services colleagues.
Okay, so, right.
the ONS does cover those industries, but it's not just picked up in sort of the construction numbers that, you know, I'm responsible for. So
your figures don't include things like surveyors and architects and engineers and people like that?
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. Okay, so it really is site-based activity that we're talking about very largely.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. So I think, as I said, that equates to about 6% of the economy based on sort of latest figures, yeah.
And Phil mentioned the man in the van who carries out a lot of the work. And a lot of those, as he said, are legitimate, you know, acting legally. But there is a black economy, isn't there, in the construction industry? There always has been. Do you make any allowance for that at all? And if so, how do you do that?
Yeah, so I think, as I was sort of saying to Phil, In the short-term figures that I'm responsible for that are very timely, we don't. I think the main reason for that is the lack of sort of available data sources that we have at that point in time. But then as you sort of go through, we have what's called a balancing sort of process as part of the national accounts. I don't want to get sort of too technical here, but that will bring in other data sources from other ONS inquiries. So for example, we have an annual business survey that goes out to the construction sector that asks for a more detailed breakdown of turnover, purchases, capital expenditure, that sort of thing. But at that point as well, you know, we'll bring in sort of undercoverage adjustments from places such as HMRC, for example. So it depends at which point in the time cycle, which periods you're interested in, sort of, you know, as to which data sources are being used. I think that's probably the best thing to say there.
Your questionnaire that you send out, your survey every month with 11 questions on it, I mean, how detailed do the answers to those questions have to be? I mean, is it, you say that, you know, the tier one contractors, they get it every month and people further down the supply chain might not necessarily. Is it a day's work to fill in this form, or is it something which you can do in a few minutes?
Yes, I mean, we try to sort of reduce the burden as sort of best we can. I mean, on average, I'd probably say it's probably maybe around about an hour, 2 hours. Obviously, it depends on the size of the business. You know, some businesses do all different types of work, don't they? So they might have to go away to lots of different places to get this information.
Do they have to fill it in? Is it a legal obligation?
It is. I should have said that, actually. Yeah, as part of the Stats of Trade Act, yeah, if you're one of the lucky businesses to be selected, you do have to fill it in. You know, we do try to work with businesses to understand, you know, reporting periods and things like that. Hopefully we don't have to go down the enforcement route and take businesses to court, but we have done that in the past because particularly the bigger businesses, they are so crucial to making sure.
When did you last take a big construction company to court?
Unfortunately, I don't know off the top of my head. What I would say is over the pandemic, we did sort of make a lot of allowances because we were well aware that an ONS form is probably, you know, one of the lower priorities for a lot of businesses to fill out.
Let me ask it another way. In the past 10 years, how many construction companies have been taken to court by ONS for not filling in their forms?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I wouldn't like to answer, unfortunately.
But it happens. It has happened.
It has happened, yeah. Not just construction, it is as other sectors as well. I mean, I think on the form we say it's up to a £5,000 fine, but like I say, we try to work with businesses to give them every opportunity. I mean, one issue we do have is, particularly in the current age, a lot of businesses think that our form is a phishing scam. You know, they see something, don't they, with a government seal of approval on the top and think, somebody's trying to, particularly when it's about, you know, financial information as well, don't they? So, you know, we do
and
try
if they
and send...
haven't had one before, presumably, they'll be suspicious.
Exactly. So we do, particularly when they're new to the survey, try to work with the business to, you know, educate them and try to explain why the data is important and the reporting sort of process and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, the questionnaire is electronic now. It has been for around about 3 years or so, but we do send out mail reminders. We do send out email reminders as well. So we do try to sort of capture sort of, you know, the different sort of modes of reporting there. Because whilst most people are au fait with sort of electronic questionnaires, not everybody is, are they? So, Yeah.
I imagine the fact that it is a legal requirement to fill it in probably concentrates minds a little bit. I mean, if it was a voluntary thing, they might want to boast about their turnover or, you know, sort of maybe manipulate the statistics that they give you out of vanity, if nothing else. But I suppose...
I would have thought the opposite. I would have thought it's in the construction industry's interest to say, oh, woe is me, we've got no work, so that the government sees that the industry is sinking 25% this year and suddenly awards
money
big, puts more money into it.
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah, exactly. Well, maybe that, yeah. But maybe the temptation to be generous with the figures or mean with the figures is reduced by the fact that they could be called to account for the information that, presumably, the information that they provided to you.
Yeah, I mean, we're very clear that we only use it for sort of our own purposes. It's not passed on to sort of anybody else. I mean, what we do is we do... validation checks. So we have their sort of annual registered VAT turnover, for example. So if it varies, you know, greatly to that, you know, we might go back to the business and try to explain and look for a bit of, you know, anecdotal evidence there. We have a comments box on the form that sometimes we get some really useful and powerful information from the businesses to try and explain any unusual movements. You know, it might be weather related, for example, where, you know, we've had a particularly bad month and they haven't picked up any work, for example. So we do have sort of checks to make sure, you know, the data is sort of sensible and in line, particularly with previous returns that the business might have submitted.
John, you're not the only organisation, of course, who gathers data and statistics about the construction industry. I like to hope and believe that yours are the most accurate because you're the official office for national statistics. You're part of the government, but there are private sector organisations and trade associations and so on who put out these tables, and I think you look at their work as well and cross check your numbers. But one thing that I with other organisations with their data gathering, that I think they sometimes trip up over, I suspect, I don't know, and I wonder if it's a challenge for you to reconcile this. Two things, actually. One, a contract is awarded, someone signs a contract and go, yes, this contract's been awarded, this is work, new orders, great. And then 2 months later, maybe there's a change of government, whatever happens is COVID, something happens, and actually it gets cancelled or it gets kicked into the long grass. And then it's re-announced, whatever, 3 months later or 6 months later, or it's never re-announced. So either it's counted when it shouldn't be counted or it's counted twice.
Yeah,
that's one issue. And a related issue is whereby you take a big project like HS2 or something and someone says, yep, I've won a £4 billion contract. And someone else comes along and says, oh, HS2, yes, I've won a £100 million contract. And that becomes not 4.1 billion because the 100 million is part of the 4 billion. And it's a subcontract and you've got to sub that out. And I sometimes think big contracts, which should be 5 billion, are being booked as 10 billion because we're adding all the subcontracts on top of the 5 billion in the first place, if you see what I mean. Yeah. How do you manage that?
Good question. And it is a challenge, I must confess. I mean, I think what we're very clear on the form that we don't want payments to subcontractors. You know, that's something that we because of double counting, you know, and if we were to sample, you know, the main contractor and the subby, you know, there is that danger, as you rightly say. So, you know, again, we've got sort of checks and balances there to make sure that if anything sort of jumps up massively, you know, we're sort of, you know, we will go back to the business and sort of query that. So I think that is a good question to ask.
So you're asking the tier one contractor, for example, what have you earned this month net of subcontractor payments?
The question is, what is the value of work that you've completed in the period that we're in the calendar month that we're asking for? So as you rightly said,
net of subcontractors.
Yes, absolutely. Right. So yes, that hopefully helps rectify that. I mean, construction is a bit of a unique sector in the fact that there is so much subcontracting sort of activity. So we do try to spell that out as much as we can. And you rightly say we have had that in the past where, you know, we have had work counted twice. You know, it's very clear that that's the case. So, I mean, I think to go back to sort of your other question as well, sort of the challenges sort of around Is it sort of the challenges around...
But they say they've got an order and then they haven't got an order.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about today so far our output numbers, which, rightly so, get a lot of...
That's money in the bank, isn't it? Yeah.
Money in the bank, spade in the ground, work done, go into sort of the monthly GDP, quarterly GDP estimates. They're really, really, really important. But as you rightly say, we also do new orders as well. So that's probably our best indicator of a forecast. We don't do forecasts at the ONS. We haven't got a crystal ball, so the line that we often come out with. But I think with new orders, you're very lucky in the construction sector that we have got that. So we have got, you know, a good sort of predictor. You know, it's not perfect. As you say, there's lots of reasons that projects can get cancelled, delayed, you know, access to funds become cancelled, that sort of thing. But I think in that regard, you know, new orders does give us that sense as to what sort of, you know, going to be taking place in a few months, quarters, years time. So I think that probably helps answer, because we've got that sort of pipeline of work that, you know, we can sort of see come in. You know, when all those HS2 orders were placed, I think in mid sort of 2017, you know, we had a good idea that would feed through to some, you know, stronger infrastructure output numbers, you know, in the very near future. And luckily, the data set that we get from our new orders data supplier, Barber ABI, has things like, you know, start dates, end dates, valuations, and we constantly monitor those sort of over time to make sure that we're then seeing that. And we can even actually see the contractors that are undertaking the work. So we've got a good, you know, sense as to, you know, the pipeline of work there, which is really helpful. I think we haven't always had that, but I think it's fair to say over the last, you know, particularly 5 or 6 years, that's been really helpful and really powerful for us.
Do you have a big team crunching all these numbers?
So on my team, we sort of do the final sort of results sort of pulling together. We've got about 6 or 7 people. There's probably about a dozen, 15 people that work on the phone, sort of collating, sort of speaking to businesses and, you know, sort of querying numbers, that sort of thing. So yeah, reasonably large team, you know.
And are you based out of Newport?
I am, yes, but we do have people now, you know, all across the country. You know, I've got people who work for me in, you know, London, and have had people a bit further north as well. You know, we are hybrid working, as is the way these days. So head office is still at Newport.
But there was a big move, wasn't there, from London to Newport? I can't remember when it was. Was that 20 years ago now or something?
I'll tell you exactly when it was, because that was the reason I joined the ONS. It was 2007 when I left university. I was looking for a job, and this just happened what's that, about 15 years or so ago? So, yeah.
Wow. We were talking about levelling up earlier, and I suppose the phrase wasn't used then, but it comes over under the same discussion about moving government departments out of London. But there was a time, and this is absolutely not your fault because you weren't there at the time, but when the first move to Wales happened, I think that a lot changed with construction statistics. I think maybe people didn't move from London to Wales, and there was sort of some expertise or some know-how sort of was lost to the organisation. And it's a bit of a starting again. And you mentioned about the improvements that you've made in recent years. I'm just interested to know how you kind of, not you personally, but as an organisation, learnt about what it needed to do and how it set about doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say, you know, as you say, it's common knowledge, you know, that sort of brain drain of, you know, expertise as we move from London to Newport, you know. You know, that was pretty fair. I mean, what I would say with construction statistics, it was a little bit different. You know, we took over, I say we, ONS took over from Bayes or the, wherever they were originally called prior, around about...
DTI then, probably.
Yeah. Probably, yeah, could well be. I know they've been through no end of renaming sort of conventions and stuff. But so ONS took over that. And at that point, there was quite a big change in the methodology. I think that was less to do with people moving and more to do with, you know, changes in terms of, you know, the data sources and method and processes, that sort of thing. So I think that's fair to say took a bit of time to bed in, as it would with any sort of new survey. So for example, if we're talking about new orders, up until 2012, 2013, we had a survey for new orders that the ONS, like I say, took over, revamped a little bit. But because the sample size was very small, it was only around about 2000, and new orders by their nature can be quite lumpy and volatile. Not every business is always undertaking new orders, so you tended to get some quirky figures. Hence, that's why we went to the private sector, Barbara ABI, who we've worked with for about 10 years, to produce the data that we need there to plug that gap. So, yeah, I think there was a change. I think it's fair to say, you know, and other areas of the office, I think, definitely experienced the issues, you know, in terms of losing personnel from London. But I think it's probably slightly different for construction statistics, and more the change of government department that was the issue, if that makes sense.
But assuming you're maintaining the spirit of continuous improvement, what are you looking? What might change in the years ahead or months ahead? What are you looking to add or do different or do better?
Yeah, I think there's a few sort of pieces of work. I mean, I think one piece of work is looking at the construction output price indices. So as I said, about 5 or 6 years ago, they were produced and created by the ONS after a development work plan where we worked with sort of users to get those up to a necessary standard. And like I said at the start, I've been badged as a national stat. I think it's fair to say that there's more work that could be done in terms of prices. You know, obviously lots of interest at the moment. You know, we do break them down to sort of the type of work sectors that we produce on an output basis. But, you know, particularly in some sectors, you know, where sort of the ad hoc nature of activity, particularly in infrastructure, say, you know, I think that's something we could possibly look at and continue to update, you know, weights and things like that go into it. So I think that's one area. I think another area is we looked at things such as our output to new orders numbers and trying to understand that relationship. So I think, you know, sometimes new orders stop, don't they, and cease for lots of different reasons, and trying to make sure that we're trying to understand that relationship and gap between the two as best we can. I think the other thing as well that we'd probably like to look at a little bit more is we've got a model that produces our sort of granular level sort of output numbers, which we sort of do a subsector. So we break down infrastructure to roads, rail, etc. We break down private industrial to houses, warehouses, factories. We've got a model that produces that. And I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of assumptions in the model, and we probably need to look to try and, you know, address those as best we can. But users like those data because obviously they are granular and detailed and quite timely, so they're able to, you know, use them for their, you know, pieces of analysis, etc. So yeah.
Who are your users mostly? I always imagine that they're people with something to sell, whether it's, you know, building product salespeople who want to know where they should be focusing their sales efforts. Is that fair, or am I missing something?
Yeah, I think we have a wide range of users. We definitely have industry, you know, companies come to us. You know, often it's they've got a contract, for example, and they've been quoted a figure to break the contract by when it comes up for renewal, and they want to actually use the official figures there rather than, you know, a 2% or a 3% increase that they've just been
on the price indices. Yeah,
exactly. So we often get that. We get a lot of trade bodies and similar sort of people come to us who use our data for forecasts and stuff like that. That's very common. And then obviously a lot of government departments as well use our data for policy decisions. So, I mean, we have a steering group that meets. We did that a few years ago, set that up. And like I say, we've got members from right across those sort of three main sectors, government, industry, and also academia as well. We have quite a few, you know, people who sort of give us a steer from that regard as well.
I bet he's got even more readers than we have, Phil.
how many have you got?
that's half as many as you.
We're not giving that away.
But do you sell information? Is there a commercial arm of ONS at all? Can you monetize what you do?
We get freedom of information requests and requests to our inbox. You know, we try our best to supply the data, particularly if it's publicly available. You know, occasionally, you know, if the request is very large, you know, there might be a small sort of monetary amount that we attach to it, but it's never, you know, it's maybe hundreds of pounds rather than thousands, something like that. But very, very occasionally would that be the case.
So essentially, it's all freely available. All your data sets, everything you put out, there's no sort of premium service that you can pay 25 grand a year to access behind the scenes of ONS. It's all there.
No, I think it's something like the open government license or something like that. All the data does have to be provided sort of free. I mean, one thing I would say is obviously disclosure is an issue. You know, businesses provide us the data. Mm. We can't, you know, go out naming company names and stuff like that. So we might occasionally have to suppress data, particularly if it's a big business in a very small sort of element of the industry. We might have to suppress a return and stuff like that. But often it is a case of, we put out lots and lots of information. So it's often a case of knowing where you want to look on the ONS website. So feel free to get in touch, and I'm sure somebody will more than happily help you and talk you through, you know, the best source.
Now, you're a professional, discreet civil servant, so I know you're not going to tell us, but I'm going to ask you anyway for a bit of gossip. So, for example, who is the first company that always gets their return back in first? And they always get, so they're always first. I'm not getting you to shame the people who are always last and late, but there must be someone who's always quick in the draw.
I would love to tell you, but unfortunately I can't. Nice try, by the way.
You can't even say that. Okay.
Not even that. I can't even narrow it down to a sector, unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah. Good try, Phil.
David, any more questions?
No, I think I've reached the end of my list.
Oh, I've got one more.
Go on then.
5% 2022 output growth. You don't have a crystal ball. But if you did, I bet it would be bigger and shinier than ours. What should we expect for 2023 based on what you know?
I think this is what I can say. I won't give you a figure for 2023, but I think new orders do look pretty strong. You know, if you compare to 2022 Q3 to 2019 Q4, I think we're about 11% up on that. So, you know, order books look pretty strong from that regard. Obviously, there's lots of factors to sort of throw into the mix and, you know, bits and bobs like that. I mean, material prices look to be coming down a little bit based on recent sort of, you know...
Coming down or not going up as quickly?
Not going up as quickly, yeah, sorry. I mean, historically, the annual rate of growth is still very high, but I think from where we were sort of 6 months, 12 months ago, I mean, obviously that is a base period effect as well, isn't it, as we move on, etc. But I think that's probably fair to say. And I think as well, a lot of the supply chain issues that we've probably seen over the last year or so in recent months, we're not getting much anecdotal evidence around those either. So I think as an industry, you know, it's reasons to be cheerful. Yeah, I think there are. I think that's all I can probably say. I wouldn't like to be a forecaster in the current climate because of obviously all the things that have gone on over the last few years, but I think there are signs for optimism. I think that's probably fair to say.
Well, that's great.
Excellent. On that note,
let's leave it there. Yeah, it's a good place to stop.
I was expecting doom and gloom, John. You've made our day.
Well, I think it's fair to say, you know, when you compare it to the financial crash, for example, you know, it doesn't look quite as bad as that. I know hindsight's a wonderful thing and all that, but, you know, I think there are signs for optimism. I think the industry's been quite resilient of late. I think that's probably fair to say. I don't know if you guys have thought anything different.
That's definitely.
Commonly been said.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
Shall we wrap it up then, Phil?
Yes. John, thank you very much for joining us and leaving us with such good and heartful news.
Yeah.
And from David and I, that's all for this week. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. So thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. And sign up for our free daily email news briefing.